It's a very large group of individuals that, very frankly, don't want anything to pass, and that's what you have to deal with.
Congressman Don Young says he's ready to vote for an end to the shutdown. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, October 15th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, former DNR Commissioner Dan Sullivan enters the U.S. Senate race.
I ask my fellow Alaskans to join me in bringing new energy to Alaska, new energy to Congress.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by ERA. For more than 40 years, ERA Alaska's planes have carried the stories of Alaska. ERA Alaska, bringing Alaskans together. More at flyera.com.
In Washington, the government shutdown continues with no resolution in sight. Alaska Congressman Don Young says the latest House proposal is going nowhere. It would have funded the government and raised the debt ceiling, but included changes to the Affordable Care Act. Young believes a solution will come from the Senate. He predicts House Speaker John Boehner will put it up for a vote, and if that happens, Young says he'll support it, despite objections from the right flank of the House Republicans.
It's not Boehner's fault. I mean, a lot of people blame the Speaker, but this is more than that. It's a very large group of individuals that, very frankly, don't want anything to pass, and that's what you have to deal with.
Young also says the minute-by-minute news reporting makes this impasse tougher to resolve than budget battles in decades past.
This is a case where we're overexposed, and it's hard for people to back down. Eagles are involved in this. And yet they know there's a problem.
Among the casualties of the shutdown is the Bering Sea crab fishery. Today was the official opening of Alaska's king crab season. About a half a dozen boats catching community development quota issued by the state got to head out and start fishing. But as KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal reports, hundreds of other fishermen were stuck in port, waiting for the federal government to reopen and issue their crab permits.
Instead of plying the Bering Sea, Chris Simpson spent the day up to his elbows in hot, soapy water.
Just scrubbing bay jars. Keeping them clean. Gotta keep them clean before you start the season.
Simpson's a crew member on the Handler, based out of Kodiak. They're one of at least 70 crab boats that can't legally fish until the National Marine Fisheries Service reopens and divides up this year's king crab limit into permits. Simpson says he's managed to find the bright side in that.
It was a lot easier this year instead of come in and slam everything on in 24 hours. It was, I'll do a few today, do a few tomorrow.
Yeah.
Now we're running out of stuff, though.
He takes me down to the galley to meet the rest of the crew. They're eating lunch and watching a movie, but Captain Joshua Songstead says this season has been anything but relaxing.
We tend to be people that take control of our own lives and our own situations. So for the government to tell us that we can't go fishing, based on some paperwork, is very frustrating.
Songstead says he's fished his whole life, and many of his crew members have too.
We've been held up for strikes. We've been held up for price negotiations. I can't recall ever being held up by permits.
The fleet is under a serious time crunch. Every year they catch as much king crab as they can before November 20th. That's when the crab has to be loaded up and shipped off to Japan for New Year's.
If our crab cannot make it there by New Year, the demand from Japan drops dramatically, and our price will drop.
That means less profit. Songstead estimates the fleet can wait about 2 more weeks before they run the risk of missing the Japanese deadline. To speed things up, the industry's been lobbying for help. A captain from one of the deadliest catch boats flew to Washington, D.C. to testify before Congress. Alaska's lawmakers even came up with a financial plan for issuing permits. Songstead says there have been no signs of progress.
There's so many different groups complaining about their needs that I think we're just kind of being lumped into that same category. You know, everybody's needing and wanting right now.
No one on the Rambler or any other boat that's stuck in port is going to get paid until they start catching crab. The 6 crew members have 17 kids among them. Daniel White says they were able to plan ahead so their families wouldn't be hit too hard.
We've done this forever, though. We know we only get 2 big checks a year, so we're usually pretty prepared for the small things, you know, but if this thing stays shut down for a while, it could screw a lot of people.
White says he has a backup plan if the season is delayed too long.
I said I'm going to need the EBT card soon.
Welfare, essentially?
Yeah, I'm going to sign up here in Dutch.
The crew of the Rambler laughs, and they agree that that's probably not what Congress had in mind when the government shut down in the first place. In On Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Among the many Americans affected by the government shutdown are scientists who rely on federal funding for their work. But that money doesn't just go to the scientists. As KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, lots of it trickles down into the community.
When I caught up with local pilot Andy Greenblatt last week, he was grounded.
I'm outside with a sledgehammer and a rod and driving down a tie down. So let me just take a couple more swings here and I'll have this thing all the way in. Perfect.
Greenblatt owns Shadow Aviation. He says 85% of the flights he's contracted to fly are paid for with state and federal dollars.
We work for Forest Service, BLM, Park Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, Fish and Game, DNR.
For nearly a decade, Greenblatt has flown with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service biologist Randy Brown.
I do mostly migration research in the Yukon River and some other drainages in northwest and northern Alaska.
Brown is in the midst of a long-term study on a species of whitefish called the Bering cisco.
It's harvested in subsistence fisheries, and it's also the target in a commercial fishery right now that got started a few years ago and markets to people in New York City. So it's the first of the whitefishes I'm aware of that has an outside market.
He says high-end restaurants are clamoring for the fish, which they like to serve smoked. But no one knows how many Bering cisco there are, where exactly they spawn, or how valuable the fishery could be. That's why he's using a method called radio telemetry to find out more.
We catch a fish without hurting it and implant a radio transmitter and then let the fish go. And then we fly aerial surveys. We get in an airplane and fly with antennas on it and identify where they are at different times.
Whitefish spawn during the first 2 weeks of October. And this is supposed to be Andy Greenblatt's third season flying with Randy Brown on this project.
But he always takes the end of September and the first part of October, and we go out radio tracking. So I always set aside that time for him and do not book other flights.
The two had scheduled up to $15,000 worth of flights this fall, but none have taken off. Greenblatt was able to pick up some extra work from the Department of Fish and Game to fill the hole in his schedule, but he spent most of his time doing other things.
I cleaned all the windows in the house the other day. I got to go clean my truck right now.
Randy Brown says he's also whittled down a long list of chores, but he can't stop thinking about the whitefish swimming up the Yukon River without him.
If we lose this season, which it appears that we will, then we would have to start all over again.
Brown's research took 3 years to develop. It's funded by the Fish and Wildlife Service's Office of Subsistence Management for $150,000. He says the loss of this year's field season could mean the loss of the project entirely.
But the likelihood in my mind that we would get another funding allocation to do it over seems reasonably small. I don't know.
Brown's isn't the only scientific research affected by the shutdown. The Alaska Volcano Observatory's monitoring efforts have been greatly limited, and many researchers at the University of Alaska Fairbanks were hoping to submit grant funding proposals to the National Science Foundation this month. In Fairbanks, I'm Emily Schwing.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the benefits and cost of having to fly to a hub community to give birth.
It's really expensive to be over here for a month. I'm not working. I had to take time off work to be over here.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Thousands of Alaskans have already gone through a home or commercial energy audit. These programs can identify ways to save a third on energy costs. For more energy and cost-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Former Department of Natural Resources Commissioner Dan Sullivan announced he's running for U.S. Senate this morning in Anchorage. Sullivan is joining a crowded field of Republicans trying to unseat Democrat Mark Begich next November. For his big speech, Sullivan wore jeans and work boots with a jacket and tie. With his wife and three daughters standing beside him, he said he would bring new energy to Alaska and Congress.
We have huge opportunities before us, especially the energy resurgence that's taking place throughout parts of Alaska and the United States. But Washington is broken.
Sullivan says he's resigned as DNR commissioner to focus 110% on the Senate campaign. He's also served as Alaska's attorney general and is a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps Reserves. Sullivan says he intends to advocate for veterans and protect the Second Amendment. He says another main focus of his campaign will be the fight against federal overreach.
Now, many people talk about this idea, but I am proud to have been on the front lines over the past 4 years, actually fighting the fight in the arena every day for our citizens on this very critical issue.
Sullivan will campaign against Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell and Joe Miller to win the Republican primary in August. Treadwell and Sullivan have already traded volleys over which candidate is more Alaskan. Both are vying for support from the Republican Party establishment. Sullivan began his campaign across the state today with stops in Wasilla and Fairbanks. In other election news, Byron Mallott has filed as a candidate for governor today, making him the first Democratic candidate to officially jump into the race. Mallott has held leadership roles with the Alaska Permanent Fund Division and the Sea Alaska Corporation. He has also served as mayor of both Juneau and Yakutat, and if elected, Mallott would also be the state's first Native governor.
I'm proud to be a first Alaskan. One of the Aboriginal peoples of this great place. But I'm running more than anything else because I'm an Alaskan first.
Mallott says he's still working on his platform and he would not give out specifics yet. He says he is concerned about Alaska's fiscal situation and that the referendum to repeal a tax cut on oil companies has made an impression on him, but he won't say whether or not he supports the referendum movement. He also says he wants to focus on education, climate change, and Alaska's position as an Arctic nation, but that he plans to do voter outreach before developing his policies.
I intend during this campaign to travel, to meet with Alaskans hopefully everywhere that they live, in their homes and in their communities, and talk about their priorities and how strongly they feel about their aspirations as they look to Alaska's future.
Mallott is the third major candidate to jump into an increasingly crowded field. Incumbent Sean Parnell is the Republican candidate, and former Valdez Mayor Bill Walker is running as an independent. A candidate from the Constitution Party, J.R. Myers, has filed as well, as has Gerald Hikes, who ran for governor as a Republican in 2010, but received less than 1% of the vote in the primary. Back in July, the Alaska Supreme Court ruled that the state was inappropriately granting permits for ATV usage on parkland. The decision affected about 200 families who use their four-wheelers to cross park lands to get to their property. Last week, the court reissued their decision, and the way they handled the case could offer a clue on how they'll handle other questions of land management, including one involving the proposed Pebble Mine. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports.
The Nancy Lake State Recreation Area covers a broad swath of land along the park's highway. It's mostly a quiet spot for hiking, camping, and fishing. And for the most part, you need to travel out there on foot.
The general rule is no ATVs.
That's Patrick Gilmore, an attorney who represents SOP Inc., which stands for Save Our Parks. He recently fought against an exception to that very rule. Ever since the 1970s, the Department of Natural Resources has been issuing permits to people who own property near the park, so they could drive along an old pioneer trail to get to their land. According to the Supreme Court opinion issued on the case, land that was supposed to be fly-in only was suddenly being advertised as ATV accessible. The Division of Parks tried to limit ATV access about a decade ago, but Gilmore says it became an access rights controversy.
So the people that were being ticketed went to their legislators, who then started threatening the Division of Parks that they were going to cut their budget if they kept enforcing the law here.
In 2002, the division set up a system where they would give out permits to private landowners if they agreed to maintain the ATV trail at their own expense. A couple hundred permits were issued. That system was supposed to limit damage to the area. But Gilmore says it didn't quite work out that way.
Last time I was out there, the beavers had gotten into one of the ruts and are damming the drainage to it and tried to make a pond out of this road. So they've just kind of made a mess out of the area.
So SOP Inc. decided to sue, arguing that by allowing ATVs on a stretch of park terrain, you're basically handing over the rights to the land. The Supreme Court agreed with that argument in an opinion this summer. Neither Gilmore nor the Division of Parks think the court ruling should have an impact on ATV use in other parks. But there was one part of the decision that wasn't exactly narrow. In a footnote toward the end of the opinion, the court said that because the ATV usage was having long-term and harmful consequences on the environment, and because no permits have ever been revoked despite the damage to land, the permits in the Nancy Lake situation fail a major judicial test. A test that could come up in some other important land management cases that go way beyond parks. Again, Gilmore.
I think the state has a real concern that this is going to impact them in some of these other cases. The biggest one that I'm aware of involves Pebble Mine.
The lawsuit he's referring to was filed by a group of Bristol Bay Native groups. They believe the state permits issued to the Pebble Limited Partnership for exploratory work are unconstitutional because they have resulted in long-term and harmful consequences to the land and can't be revoked at will. A party close to the Pebble lawsuit says they eyed the footnote with interest because it could impact how the court may rule in their own case. So, with a major question of land management in play, the state applied for a rehearing. They wanted a new version of the opinion that took the footnote out. John Baker, the state attorney who handled the case, says that yes, the expansiveness of that footnote could have had legal consequences.
Well, the concern was that in the state's view, it suggested a much broader application of the tests in that earlier case, the Northern Alaska Environmental Center case, than we believed was originally intended by the court's decision there.
Baker says the state didn't have a specific case in mind, and he's not sure how the language would have affected the Pebble case exactly. In the end, the Supreme Court got rid of the footnote. So the Nancy Lake case probably won't go down in Alaska legal history as a precedent-setting permitting decision. But it may give a hint of how this court feels about land management and how the state is handling it. If they do apply the same logic in the Pebble case, it could affect a lot more than just a group of ATV users. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Anchorage police say a newborn baby was found dead in an Eagle River park, and they are looking for the mother. Police in a statement say the mother may need medical attention and encourage her to contact a local hospital. A person found the newborn not breathing just after 9:30 this morning at Turner Park. The baby was wrapped in a towel. The body will be sent to the state medical examiner to determine the cause of death.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority is developing the Kinnick Arm Crossing to further develop the transportation system between Anchorage and the Matsu Borough. The bridge could create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and shorten the route to Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
The state's Joint Board of Fisheries and Game is meeting in Anchorage. They decided to create an advisory committee just for the community of Bethel. Angela Denning Barnes reports.
With over 6,000 residents, Bethel continues to grow as the hub of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. The community currently has one seat on the Lower Kuskokwim Advisory Committee, but local groups approached the joint board about getting their own. Several letters of support were submitted from the Central Kuskokwim Advisory Committee, Bethel Native Corporation, and Okotsagagamute Native Council, Bethel's native tribe. Board member Pete Babrasco of Palmer spoke in favor.
Bethel is over 6,000 people. I think they deserve more representation.
Board of Game member Robert Mumford of Anchorage was the only dissenting vote. Sue Jeffrey of Kodiak with the Board of Fish said it was the right move.
I think that in creating an advisory committee, it will, help facilitate communication throughout the region. It makes sense for all kinds of reasons.
There will be costs associated with the state running another advisory committee, and some board members had concerns about that. But the Board of Fish's John Jensen of Petersburg said he believed the extra cost would be manageable.
I think there's ways that we can make up for that, especially down in the southeast where there's some inactive ones and there's some communities that are connected by the road system that are close together. And you could make a single one out of three that I can think of right now down there. So I think there's ways to this will work. I don't think it's going to be a huge extra cost.
Board of Game member Stosh Hoffman of Bethel abstained from the vote. The Alaska Joint Board of Fisheries and Game has been meeting in Anchorage since Saturday. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
Alaska has become a nationwide leader in healthy births. KRBD's Sean Carlson explores how Ketchikan Medical Center plays a part in that trend.
If you go right through that front door there that you came through to the front door across the way, elevator's right to the left.
Right.
Go up to the third floor and it's all the way down.
This is the Landing Hotel in Ketchikan. It's flooded with charter fishermen and other tourists this time of year, which makes it one of the town's busier places to stay.
Hey, Kelly.
Hi, yes.
I'm Sean. It's nice to meet you.
Right now, the Landing is hosting a different sort of visitor, and her story is part of a medical trend that has made Alaska the best in the nation in an unlikely area.
My name is Kelly Taylor. I am 24 years old, and I am 37 weeks pregnant today.
Kelly is due to give birth in about 3 weeks. Her previous pregnancy was complicated, so her doctors are taking a few extra precautions. But other than that, she seems pretty normal, with a healthy sense of humor about the sights she's seen in Ketchikan so far.
We've walked around the mall a couple times, the greatest mall in Alaska. There's a Walmart here.
That's what everybody said.
But there is something unconventional about Kelly's situation. She's from Klawak on Prince of Wales Island. That's about 70 miles from Ketchikan. The medical center in Ketchikan is the closest facility equipped to deliver babies. And as a policy, the women's clinic in the city requires pregnant women from rural communities to travel to Ketchikan at least 2 weeks before their due date. So women like Kelly get on a ferry or float plane while very pregnant to the city, and then they wait and wait.
Yeah, I'm definitely bored out of my mind for sure.
But despite Kelly's boredom, her situation represents a radical transformation from what Alaska prenatal care was like 30 years ago. That change, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, is responsible for a dramatic turnaround. Alaska used to have the worst infant and neonatal mortality rates in the nation. Now it has the best. If Alaska was its own country, it would tie Switzerland and give Scandinavia a run for its money. Representatives from Alaska medical advocacy groups say the state's rise to the top is due in large part to advances in how care is provided in often remote locations. Dr. Matt Hirschfeld has been on the front lines of that change at the Native Medical Center in Anchorage.
Beginning in the early 80s, late 70s, people in Alaska realized that there had to be a better way to deliver care to women so that they had a more healthy baby when the baby was born. And so there became a concerted effort between the Alaska Tribal Health System, Providence Hospital, the state of Alaska, to develop a system such that women had healthier babies when they were born.
Medical centers in the state use a mix of midwives and OBGYN doctors to deliver that care. If the woman, such as Kelly, is in a remote town or village, midwives are flown or ferried in every month to conduct regular checkups. Then the medical center requires the woman to travel 2 to 4 weeks before their due date and wait for delivery. Marta Poor has worked as a midwife with the Ketchikan Medical Center for nearly 3 decades and has seen this medical transformation firsthand. In her own words, medical care in some villages back then was akin to that in third world countries.
Because I know one woman, preterm twin pregnancy, I can still remember, they're trying to prepare for a medevac, and she's got her husband out there cutting down trees so they can clear a spot big enough for the helicopter to come in.
Like everything in Southeast, aspects of the system that have developed are uniquely Well, Alaskan representatives from the Ketchikan Medical Center say that more than half of those who come from out of town are Alaska Native. At least 75% of the women are on Medicaid. That's good for the patients, as the coverage pays for both their transportation to Ketchikan and much of the cost of their stay. Even so, coming to Ketchikan can be costly. Kelly Taylor's fiancé, who works at a grocery store in Klawak, couldn't afford to take the time off to stay with her, and Kelly, who works in the same store, is obviously also not working while she's in Ketchikan.
It's really expensive to be over here for a month. I'm not working. I had to take time off work to be over here because that's what the doctors recommended me to do. You know, if it were up to me, I'd be at home right now and I'd fly over if my water broke or something.
Kelly's mother is spending the full 3 weeks with her, though, at a cost of at least $200. And although Medicaid covers some food costs, the voucher can only be used in the Landing's restaurant. The boredom and cost can be so great for the women, the midwife Marta Poor says a unique phenomenon develops.
There's a lot of pressure to induce. And especially you got two or three kids on the other island that you got, you know, somebody in the family watching. But you want those kids. You're here all by yourself. Your husband needs to work as far as logging or timber or whatever, or fishing, whatever he's doing. Then you may find a woman here all by herself and she is depressed. I mean, and then her husband comes in for the weekend and you want that baby now.
Of course, the doctors and midwives can't ethically do much to help the women deliver early, beyond recommending spicy foods or walking. Kelly's mother, who has delivered three babies this way in Ketchikan, understands her daughter's situation. And now that the younger woman is going through it, they both agree.
It's the worst part about being pregnant. It's coming over to Ketchikan to wait.
Yeah.
Kelly says that if given the option, she'd choose to give birth at home, even though it would be higher risk. Dr. Matt Hirschfeld says he is happy with how prenatal care in the state has progressed. But he admits there's still room for improvement, especially in that almost purgatorial wait period for the women before they give birth.
I mean, the goal is to get this rate to a zero. We have these moms who are here in Anchorage or in Bethel or in Ketchikan who are here for weeks before they deliver, and we really don't do enough with that time. We have a captive audience. We can really have some major effects on their pregnancy if we had a concerted effort towards education.
And he says there may be some lessons for the rest of the United States in Alaska's transformation. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Sean Carlson.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, and Sean Carlson in Ketchikan. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Crowley, celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at crowleyalaska.com.
And by Alex Hotel and Suites, featuring amenities that include a 24-hour airport shuttle, hot continental breakfast, and a walk-in freezer. Information on Alaska resident rates at 1-800-221-7550. Those living with asthma know that each day their life can take several different routes. So take care of yourself with daily medication and you'll be well-rested and eager to take on the day. Miss taking your medication and you'll end up with restless sleep, days at home sick, or even in the emergency room. So treat your asthma even when you're feeling your best to keep you from your worst. Information at asthmainalaska.org or 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.